Welcome to the So-and-So series, readings by early career poets. Thank you for your patience. I am technologically unsavvy. Our final author is James Tate. He is the author of numerous books of poetry and prose, most recently The Ghost Soldier from Echo, this year. His selected poems won the Pulitzer Prize and the William Carlos Williams Award in 1991. His other honors include a National Book Award and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. He teaches at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And I've never written an intro before, because I feel like I'd be bad at it, so I always just read the bios. But I feel, I have to say, it's an honor to have you here. Many of us here, many of our readers throughout the So-and-So have been influenced, if not directly, their aesthetics by James Tate. But certainly, I know when I first read James Tate, it expanded my idea of what a poem could be, what a poem could do, what poem. And it, for me, it came at a time where I needed to have joy put back into poems, and that's what it did for me. James Tate, thank you very much.
To be here. Hope you all can hear me.
And I
hope that I can read. All right. Things are a little fuzzy. This is called Uneasy About the Sounds of Some Night Wandering Animal. On the way to work this morning, radio said, a big part of reality has been removed. It has been reported. Details are not available at this time. It's just that I am told you'll find things different on your drive to work this morning. Some roads will be missing. Whole areas of the city may be gone. However, the good news is no signs of violence have been detected. I turned the radio off. There wasn't the usual rush hour traffic, for which I was grateful. I wasn't even sure I was on the right road. There were empty fields where I'd remembered rows and buildings. Then I went into a long tunnel, and I had no memory of there being a tunnel there. When I came out of it, there was nothing, or rather, I guess it was a desert, as I had never been in it before. I looked around for signs of the city. A jackrabbit scurried across the road, and up ahead a policeman was leaning against his motorcycle. I slowed down instinctively and then pulled over to stop. Good morning, officer, I said. Wrong turn. Could you tell me where I am? Not exactly, he said. This seems to be a new area. It wasn't here before. We're still trying to identify it. I suggest you drive with caution, because, well, we have no information on it yet. I know it's dry. Well, thanks, I said. My stomach was sinking. I was certain to be late to work. I didn't know what to do. Part of me wanted to drive on, see what was out there, and part of me wanted to turn back. But I wasn't sure fine there. So I drove on for miles and miles, sand dunes shifting and stirring, and the occasional Hawker buzzers circling overhead. Then the road disappeared, and I was forced to stop and look behind me. That road too was blown over by sand in a few seconds. I got out of the car, glad that I had some water with me. I looked around, and it was all the same. Nothing made any sense. I tried to call Harvey at the office on my cell phone. I couldn't believe when he answered. "Harvey, I'm out here in this new place. It's all sand and there are no roads." I said, "We'll come and get you," he said. "But I don't know where I am. I mean, I don't even know if it exists," I said. "Don't be ridiculous, Carl. Of course it exists. Just look around and give me something to go. There's nothing here. Oh, there was a tunnel some miles back and a policeman leaning up against his motorcycle. That's the last thing I saw," I said. "Was it the old Larchmont tunnel?" he said. "I don't know. It could have been. I was lost already," I said. "Okay, I'll stay put," he said. I waited and waited. And then I just started walking. I know I wasn't supposed to, but I was restless and hoped I might find a way out. I had been lost. I lost, had no idea where I was. The sun was blinding me, and I couldn't think straight. I barely knew who I was. And then, as if by miracle, I could hear Harvey's voice call my name. I looked around, but couldn't see him. "Carl, Carl, I'm here," he said. And I still couldn't see him. "We've fallen off. We're in the fallen off zone," he said. "What? What does that mean?" I said. "We've separated. It may be temporary. It's too soon to tell," he said. "But where are we?" "We must be in some relation to something," he said. "I think we're parallel," he said. "Parallel to what?" I said. "Parallel to everything that matters," he said. "Then that's good," I said. I still couldn't see him. The night was coming on. It was a parallel night, much like the other. And that was some cold comfort, as they like to say. This is called "Long Live the Queen." When the little man opened his walk like a bird, so I grabbed him by the shoulders, spun him around, and threw him down the steps. I ran down the steps and picked him up. He had a bump on his forehead, but other than that, he seemed to be in fine shape. "What do you say now?" I said. "Was it that ticked you off?" he said. I socked him in the eye. Then I socked him in the other eye. He squawked and fell to the ground. I picked up his feet and dragged him across the floor. "Stand up," I said. His legs thrashed around a bit, but finally he was able to stand. "Do you suppose I could have a glass of water?" He said, "Certainly," I said. Fetched him a glass of water. I watched him gulp it down. And then I said, "See this hammer? I'm going to hit you on the head with it." "That will surely hurt," he said. I raised the hammer and brought it down. Again, he slumped to the ground. I made myself a cheese sandwich and ate it in the other room. When I went back, he was still out. So I filled up his water glass and threw it in his face. He opened his eyes and looked at me. "Who are you?" he said. "And who I am. Stand up. You spend far too much time napping. It's not good for you," I said. He struggled and fell over several times. Finally, I lent him a hand, and he made it to his feet. I picked the whip up off the chair. "You're going to like this," I said. I lashed him a good one. He let out a squeak. I lashed him 20 times all told. Blood soaked through his shirt. "Oh my," he said. "You are certainly an expert with that device." "Why, thank you," I said, and pride in my technique. He was covered in sweat, and his hair was standing on end. "Perhaps you would like a little rest before we move on to the next step," I said. "A little rest would be most welcome," he said. "Have a seat," I said. He was breathing rather heavily. "Well, it has occurred to me, sir," he said. "Of course, the matter of an explanation is strictly voluntary." "I don't owe it to you," I said. "Oh, yes, sir, I understand that," he said. "However, since you have been so cooperative, I will tell you this. It has nothing to do with the Queen." He stared at me with his mouth open. "That's it? That's all you're going to tell me?" he said. "Don't you feel better now?" he said. I said, "Yes, sir. Thank you, sir," he said. "Well, I think we've had enough of a rest. Back to work," I said. I threw him against the wall, then kneed him in the stomach against the wall, then smashed him in the face. When he fell to the floor, I kicked him in the ribs. He laid there, moaning and sputtering. I lay down beside him. "You're quite a remarkable man, you know," I said, "with many admirable qualities. The Queen would like to meet you at tea. She's a single lady now that her husband, the King, has died. She's very attractive for her age, which I believe is the same as yours. I don't mean to put any ideas in your head, but I hope you'll think it over," I said. "Over," I said. This is called national security. I said, "I want to go home." "I told you we have no home," Ann said. "What happened to our home?" I said. "The government took." "What for?" I said. "They said it was for strategic reasons," she said. And thus we commenced our roaming. Mostly we stayed at campsites along the way. We had a tent and sleeping bags, a couple of pots and pans. I was confused about us, but I also liked the adventure. Once a man came over and said he and his wife would like to share their dinner with us. Anne said her husband wasn't feeling well. I said, "I feel great. We sat around their campfire and talked. The man said he used to be a dentist, but now you should have been picking those little caps out of people's mouths all along. You'd be rich, I said, and plowed her elbow into my ribs. We're headed for the Klondike piece, his wife said. It's best to stay out of the strategic zones, Anne said. They nodded in unison. But I still don't know where they are, I said. They all look the same to me. They didn't say anything. We ate some awful strange meat and some baked beans. At least I think that's what they were. Later in the morning when we'd been on the road about 3 hours, a band of Indians came riding toward us. What are we supposed to do? I said to Ann. They've risen up all over the country. They're on the warpath. They're going to take over the government, she said. But what about us right now? I said. Just be nice, she said. But they came alongside the car and stopped and rolled down the window. Howdy, fellow Americans, she said. Can you tell us how to get to Topeka, he said. Sure, they proceeded to give him directions. That's most helpful, he said. Have a nice day. We drove on into the glaring sun. Where are we going, I said. Do I look like I know where we're going? I just want to get as far as we can. As we can, she said. What about our old? You'll just have to make new ones, she said. Patagonia, is that where we're going, I said. No, we're not going to Patagonia. I don't know where we're going. We're getting low on gas, and I don't think there's going to be a gas station for a long time, I said. Walk, she said. I was beginning to see how crazed she was, and it frightened me. We don't have anything to eat, I said. You can kill a jackrabbit, she said. There was an old shepherd up ahead, moving his flock across the road. When we pulled to a stop, she said, grab one of those sheep and throw it in the back seat. I said, I'm not going to do that. There's no way. She looked at me and opened her door and went and grabbed a sheep around the waist and tried to heft it up. She dropped it and tried again. It took her to drag it over to the car. She finally managed to stuff it in the back seat before the shepherd saw what she had done. He pounded on her window and hit it with his staff. A curse on you! I put a curse on you, he shouted. She rolled down her and yelled back at him. National security! It's for your own good! Ice cream man. I answered the ad in the paper. I'd been unemployed for 9 months and I was desperate. At the interview, the man said, do you have much experience climbing tall mountains? Absolutely, I climb them all the time. If I see a tall mountain, I have to climb it immediately. What about swimming long distances? In rough ocean waters, perhaps in a storm, he said. I'm like a fish. You can't stop me. I just keep going in all kinds of weather, I said. Could you fly a guider at night and land in a wheat field, possibly under enemy fire, he said. Nothing could come more naturally to me, I said. How are you with explosives? Would a large building, say 20 stories high, present you with much difficulty, he said. Certainly not. I pride myself on a certain expertise, I said. You are fully acquainted with the latest in rocket launchers and landmines, he said. I even own a few of those for personal use. They're definitely no problem for me, I said. Now, Mr. Strafford, or may I call you Stephen, what you'll be doing is driving one of our ice cream, selling ice cream to all the little kids in the neighborhood. But sometimes things get tricky, and we like all our drivers to be well-trained and well-equipped to face any eventuality. You know, some fathers can get quite irate if you are out of their kid's favorite flavor. Or the kid drops a cone, he said. I understand. I wouldn't hesitate to take appropriate action, I said. And there are certain neighborhoods when you're under advisement to expect the worst. Sneak attacks, gang tactics, dropping from trees and rising out of manholes. Blockades, machine gun fire, launched explosives, flamethrowers, and that kind of thing. Can you do a little business there if you were on your toes? You see what I'm saying? He said. No problem. I know those kinds of neighborhoods. Kids still want their ice cream, and I wouldn't let them down, I said. Good, Stephen. I think you're going to like this job. It's exciting and challenging. We've, of course, lost a few drivers over the years, but mostly it was because they weren't paying attention. It's what I call the suplex. They thought they were there just to make the kids happy. But there's a lot more to it than that. One of our best drivers had to level half the city once. Of course, that was an extreme case, but he did what needed to be done. We'll count on you to be able to make that count. You'll have to have all your weapons loaded and ready to go in a moment's notice. You'll have your escape plans with you at all times. Yes, sir. I'll be ready at all times, and as you know, some of the ice cream is lethal. That will require a quick judgment call on your part as well. Mistakes will inevitably be made. You try to keep them to a minimum. Otherwise, the front office becomes flooded with paperwork, he said. I can assure you, I will use them only when I deem it absolutely necessary, I said. Well, Stephen, I look forward to your joining our team. They're mostly crack professionals, Navy SEALs, that kind of thing. At the end of the day, you've made all those kids happy, but you've also thinned out the bad seeds and made our city a safer place to be, he said. He sat there smiling with immense pride. How will I know which flavor, I said. Experiment, he said. I looked stunned. Then we both started laughing. Okay, this will be the last one. This is called The Land of the Vapors. A rockhammer's field just outside of town. It didn't explode or anything, just stuck straight down in the cow pasture. Word got out right away and the crowd started to gather. Shortly after, the state police arrived and forced everyone back to a safe distance. The farmer made sure on the barn. Then several army trucks arrived and sent in several experts to look at the rockets. They were covered in all manner of protective gear. The rest of the soldiers assisted in keeping the crowd at a safe distance. I spotted Kim and walked over to her. Embarrassing, isn't it? I said. I'm not sure I want these people protecting us, she said. This isn't the first time this has happened around here, I said. I know. There was that schoolhouse a couple of years ago, she said. One of the soldiers turned around. I wish it wouldn't be so hard on us to get used to the new system, he said. He looked so sad. I almost forgave him. Well, couldn't you experiment with it out in the desert or something? I said. They did. They said everything was working fine, he said. Well, one of these days we're going to a little town and everybody in it. Do you really think that's okay? I said. No, sir, I don't, he said. It's not his fault, Kim said to me. I know, I said. Just then there was a tremendous explosion. Most of the crowd, soldiers and policemen, had been knocked to the ground, some of them bleeding, some injured quite badly. Two soldiers who had been working on the rocket had vaporized, not a trace of them, and the barn had been flattened. Few of the cows still standing. The farmer started caressing his decimated herd. I helped Kim to her feet. She had a cut above her left eye. The soldier who had been talking to us was unconscious or possibly dead. I felt his pulse still alive. He'll be all right soon, I think, I said to Kim. I gave her my handkerchief. Hold this over your eye. We started to walk among the others. The ambulances will be here soon, I kept saying over those who needed help. I knelt down to one old lady and helped her find her rosary. She thanked me and smiled. I gave sips of water to a young boy with parched lips. Finally, the ambulances did arrive and started carting away the wounded. One said to me, they train us for this kind of thing, but it never does any good. A goddamn field of cows. Who could have expected that? Yeah, that farmer lost half his herd and his barn. And nobody is going to care about that, I said. Thinking about that, I was thinking about what a waste of a good missile, he said. Kim and I drove back to town. Do you want me to take you to the hospital so you can get your eyes stitched up? I said, no, I'll be all right, she said. I'm not going to go chasing missiles again. That was a mistake, I said. Oh, don't say that, Brad. You know it's the most exciting thing that ever happens around here. If it weren't for the Army, Barry, dull little town. As it is, it's almost as if we were at war with ourselves, which puts a whole other spin on things. You don't really hate anybody, which is a big relief, she said. But one of the men who were vaporized, I said, that was their calling. They went happily to the land of vapors, she said. Thank you. Thank you so much.